Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman, and I am psyched to have with me again, Scott Jeffrey Miller. Capping a 25-year career where he served as Chief Marketing Officer and Executive Vice President of BD, Scott currently serves as Franklin Covey's Senior Advisor on Thought Leadership. Scott hosts the Franklin Covey-sponsored On Leadership with Scott Miller, the world's fastest-growing leadership podcast, reaching more than 6 million people weekly. Not bad. I hope to get to that point at some day. And he's interviewed some of the most brilliant minds on the planet. Scott is also the author of the award-winning multi-volume Mess to Success series, and the latest one being Management Mess to Leadership Success, 30 Challenges to Become the Leader You Would Follow, and the soon-to-be-released Marketing Mess. Oh, sorry. Yeah, Marketing Mess to
Brand Success. Just released this week. Yeah.
I was like, wait. So he's the co-author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller, Everyone Deserves a Great Manager, The 6 Critical Practices for Leading a Team. He's written a bunch of books, so definitely check it out. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Scott. Scott, how are you?
I'm great, John. Doctor, thank you for inviting me back and shining your spotlight on me and giving me your platform. I'm delighted and honored.
My pleasure. Call me John. Yeah, don't worry about the doctor thing.
I don't
like all that hierarchical stuff.
I might do it a few times because that's harder. It was bought.
But I'm trying to forget it desperately.
I don't know. I'm impressed.
So, before we dive into the book, well, and congratulations on the latest book. How many books have you written all told?
I've written 7. I released 4. 3 are coming out in the next 18 months. And I've got commitments for 16 more books between 2 publishers over the next 10 years. So I've got some books in the queue.
Amazing. And then you parent in your spare time.
Co-parent, my wife. We do. We have 3. Yeah. Good memory. We have 3 sons that are 6, 9, and 11, and they all have my personality, 3 boys. So I got a lot going on.
Yeah, I don't really know how you do it. I could use some of your energy. But before we dive into the book, give me one or two stories from the wealth of interviews that you've done on your podcast, because you've interviewed some brilliant minds.
Wow, I have. As you mentioned, I'm privileged to host what is the world's largest now weekly leadership podcast, hitting 8 million. It's growing exponentially.
Wow.
Not because of me, but because of the guests that we have and the resonance that the subscribers find with them. Gosh, you know, I interviewed Jen Sincero. She's the former coach and famous author of the series, The Badass Series. You are a badass.
Yes.
You are a badass with money. And I was surprised. I was so impressed by her. You know, this is a woman who's very comfortable in her skin. I love these books, right? You are the whole You Are a Badass series.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically spent an hour giving all of our subscribers and listeners just permission to be themselves. And, you know, in a conservative corporate public company like Franklin Covey, you know, I think increasingly we want people to be themselves, but I'm not sure we were always that way. I think companies are becoming much more progressive. They want to retain and recruit quality talent. Well, that I could always be myself at Franklin Covey the entire time. Welcome to any organization or family, right? Or community of people, social construct. So this sounds odd at 53, but I'm increasingly giving myself permission to be myself. And I hope your listeners and viewers do too. You know, another great book was David Epstein with the book Range. Amazing book. This book hit, I think, number 2 on the Wall Street Journal list. He writes this book in Range where he talks about there's 2 types of professionals, specialists and generalists. And not everyone falls into that category. But I think it's important as you're looking to build a deliberate career, recognizing, are you a specialist, chemical engineer, podiatrist, commercial airline pilot? Or are you a generalist, marketer, salesperson, project manager? And being comfortable, I think most specialists are very confident in the badge they wear. I think a lot of generalists are less comfortable in the badge that they wear because the badge isn't clear. And so I'd say to all of you who are generalists like me, your time will come. All that information you assimilated will come and pay you dividends. And then lastly, I interviewed Matthew McConaughey. And of course, that was a wild ride, right? And such a great interview, such a gentleman and so authentic about who he is and what he believes and what he's learning. And he shared a profound insight, John, where he said, you know, he was quoting a friend's grandfather that said, he'd loosely quoted, he'd spent his entire life fixated worrying about thousands of problems, a few of which came true.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I've kind of misquoted that, but that so helps me to realize that most of the problems I'm fixated worrying about aren't happening.
Well, and actually there's research that shows that 85% of those things that we worry about, actually the outcome is far more positive.
Wow.
And I would say in my experience, it's more like 90 or 95%.
You've just given me a great gift. I need to put down all of my budget issues with my sons and realize that, you know what? 90% of them I'm going to be able to afford. I'm glad.
Well, they're all about the stories we're spinning in our head, right? And so I think a great question to ask ourselves is, what's the story you're telling yourself right now? Because I can destroy the world in less than 3 seconds in my own mind.
Yeah, right.
I mean, just to, you know, kind of over-exaggerate it, but honestly, I can be fired. I could lose all my clients. I could be penniless. I mean, like, you can go in these thought spirals, right? And they're not connected with reality in most ways.
It's, you know what? Beautifully said. I was with a colleague 2 days ago. I was giving a speech, a live speech, in person, in an audience, in Detroit.
What? They have those?
What's that?
They have those?
They're back on. I've done two in the last week. I know.
Wow. Okay. Now you've given me permission.
I know. And Dr. Fauci and the CDC says masks are off. If you're vaccinated, the world is back. Not exactly. And I was with a colleague, a person more junior to me in terms of age and experience and income. And I asked them what their biggest fear was. And her answer was financial uncertainty. And she asked me what my biggest fear was. And my answer, without skipping a beat, John, was financial uncertainty. And we have nothing in common, including the commas in our tax returns, right? It's all perspective, is it not? I would not have thought that at my level of mess and success at 53, and I've done well professionally and financially, but my biggest concern is still financial uncertainty. And so is hers. And she's on the early side of her journey. I thought a lot about, okay, so going forward, should my biggest fear be financial uncertainty? Maybe I choose a different fear.
Yeah, no, I think it's all about perspective. And I think that's one of the ways that we get happier as we get older is we gain greater perspective and we realize what's worth worrying about and what we can let go of. At this point in my career, the only thing that I really get sketched out about is life and death. Like if I really don't take a whole lot seriously these days, unless it's life or death. If it's life or death, you have my attention.
Well, you've had some health, you know, challenges that you're overcoming mm-hmm. in the last year. I don't, that I know of.
But and we're the same age.
We're the similar age. You're better looking than I am and more successful and more educated. But I have a couple more books. That's it. You know, me too, right? I don't worry about dying. I worry about leaving my wife and my children without a husband and father. They're taken care of financially if I die. Probably better. You're probably better off if I die, actually. And my wife is aware of that.
But this brings up an interesting paradox. I mean, I think that we humans are walking contradictions. I think we're filled with paradox and inconsistencies. And it fascinates me that I believe to the extent we can get comfortable with like the idea of divorce, that we can more fully be in our marriage. To the extent that we can get comfortable with the idea of death, we can more fully embrace life. And so I think that there's really something, and you know, the Tibetan Buddhist monks would meditate, they have death meditations. And when I first heard about that, I had this disgust reaction, like, ooh, like, why? But the whole purpose is to recognize the impermanence of everything and to be less attached to everything around them, in particular, their own life.
See, in all podcasts, people come for the guest, but they stay for the host.
Well, that's why you have 6 million podcast, listeners, 8 million listeners.
This is why your podcast is so popular, is because of your wisdom. I should really just shut up and listen to you. So.
Okay, wait. I have a great question for you, though, because I don't normally do this, but I know you a little bit, and I just thought this would be kind of fun. So in an effort to plumb the depths of your brilliant mind, I have to share a brief context first.
This will be a shallow.
Oh yeah, this is a setup. So I was speaking with Dr. Yosef Parvizi yesterday, and he's a brilliant neurological researcher at Stanford. And I won't even make a Stanford joke there, but we were talking about the default network, and that's the network in the brain that activates when we're daydreaming, like when you're staring off into space or at a wall. And it seems like this network is involved in meaning making and mental time travel, so taking us to the past or the future. So thinking about your own mind, just imagine a 3x2 grid, which on the top half has positive past, positive present, positive future. And on the bottom, it has negative past, negative present, negative future. Where do you see yourself spending the majority of your mental time?
Well, I've had a pivot in the last 6 months. As you know, I was an officer in a firm for 25 years. I separated very amicably with that firm, Franklin Covey, in November. I'm still an ambassador and a paid advisor to them for hopefully the next decade or so. And so I've been a bit liberated. You know, I'm a little more free now to think more outrageously. I'm free to, you know, speak my mind more. My brand is still attached to their brand, and I take that fiduciary responsibility very seriously. So I would say I have disrupted myself in the last 6 months pretty significantly. And I quit a seven-figure job in the middle of a pandemic to go pursue my dream, my passions.
Congratulations, so by the way.
Well, thank you. That was idiotic of me and horrible timing, but too late now.
Courageous. It's a fine line.
Courageous, exactly. Seth Godin has taught me the fine line between being fearless and being reckless. And I'm like precariously perched there. But I think I'm spending the majority of my time fixated on the future. And for the first time in my life, thinking more than a year or two out, right? What does my brand, my contribution look like 9 books into the Mess to Success series, not 2.5? And really thinking about what kind of parent do I need to become for my teenage boys 3, 4, 5, 6 years from now? This is a different parenting style than I have right now. I have no regrets in life. I can say that not as a cliche. Like I've said things that I wish I hadn't, but significantly, I have very few regrets, if any. And I use every failure, of which I've got, well, a lot, because I talk about 30 of them in my new book, Marketing Mess. I use every failure and setback. I had 3 doors shut on me yesterday, like big doors, bam, 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 that were key to my 2022. And I'm mindful of this phrase, you know, sometimes a disappointment is really an appointment. So like today, for example, I'm spending my time not lamenting on these like locked doors on me. Okay, so what does that mean? Is that the gift that is making me focus now on some smaller things that I really should be done? So next year, instead of water skiing across 9 things, I'm going to scuba dive across 2 things. So I'm spending all my time, hopefully on the far end of this matrix, thinking about the future, my future contribution, who is my smallest viable market. I don't spend much time dealing with the haters. I don't read most of my Amazon reviews because, you know, every 9th one is someone taking me down, and there's 10 that are great or 8 that are great. I've, you know, as you turn 50, something changes, does it not? You care a little bit less what people think about you. You find your tribe and you blaze towards it.
I love the metaphor of water skiing and scuba diving. Well,
it's one of my chapters in the book, right? It's one of my chapters is this concept of more is not better. Better is better. I mean, of all these people I've interviewed, John, you know, 150 of the biggest authors and stars you've interviewed and know many of them yourself. There are three things that I've learned from all of them. These are like major people, Dan Pink and Ann Chow and Liz Wiseman and General McChrystal and Doris Kearns Goodwin. And yesterday I interviewed a couple days ago, Emmanuel Acho, the author of the book, you know, Uncomfortable Conversation with Black Man. They all have 3 things in common. They work their asses off, right? They work harder than anybody. 2, they have lots of failures, right? There's no such thing as overnight success. There's overnight fame, like Lorena Bobbitt, Google her from the 80s. But there's no such thing as overnight success. They all have a trove of books you never read about because no one bought them. They all have TV pilots that were taped that you never saw. They all had movies that were never released. It's amazing how many failures these huge stars have. And 2 is they learn to compartmentalize whose feedback they take, right? And they become more introspective and self-aware, but they're able to compartmentalize the hate and the vitriol, which is often jealousy, right? Mm-hmm. And they go where their tribe is, and they're unstoppable in terms of their momentum. because they have balanced confidence and humility together.
Well, it's, you know, you mentioned jealousy, and I always like to make the distinction between jealousy and envy.
Please.
And jealousy, I think, is because I think this ties into, you know, your haters or all haters. Jealousy is where you have something that I want. Envy is where you have something I want and I don't want you to have it. And I think, you know, envy to me is, it's a dangerous emotion. Yeah. Like it's only destructive.
Yeah.
Like I can be jealous of your success and let it, you know, I can be motivated by your success to find more of my own. Like I think, so I could use jealousy as a positive motivator in that way. Envy means I'm going to try and sabotage your success. And that's, it's just messed up.
And we see it out there.
I mean, I've seen it in like high school couples, right? When I was dealing with adolescents, I remember I had a guy come in and he has a girlfriend and he's like, yeah, there's this other guy that I know that really wants to get with my girlfriend. And he took a girl's phone and texted my girlfriend saying, oh yeah, I hooked up with your boyfriend at the house party on Saturday night. Like that kind of thing. And it's just, it's nasty.
It's nasty. Your original point around water skiing versus scuba diving, another thing that these massive influential leaders that I've interviewed or met have is they have this unnatural discipline to say no to distractions. They have a fierce focus on one or two things. They're not doing nine things. And this is an area of growth for me. One of my messes, John, is that, you know, at any given time I'm writing blogs and columns and articles and TV pilots and radio programs and podcasts and books and parenting, right? And some deep down need I have to be loved. Someday I'll be in your office and you'll fix me. But what these people have in common that are unnaturally successful is they have this ability to say no and to be and to make the one thing to keep the main thing. And they build a brand around usually a singular topic or expertise. And that's a struggle for me because I get so interested and distracted. And I have this kind of curious mind where I like to fill it. But then what happens is I have more ideas and more offers and more interest. And so this is a good lesson for all of your listeners and subscribers and readers of
Absolutely.
My book, is to recognize that more is not better, except for pizza, bread, butter, beer.
Well, it depends how old we are.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well,
you can say that.
I have to admit that I purposefully have steered the conversation away from marketing because I don't know jack about marketing. You know, in graduate school, we're taught that marketing for psychologists borders on unethical and evil. So knowing that I'm a marketing virgin, just take it easy on me. So let's turn the chapter to a little bit on your book. And, you know, I was looking at the second challenge, the idea that marketing is not just a division.
Yeah.
And you emphasize the importance of getting everyone to act as brand ambassador. And my mind went to, well, wait, but 75% of the workforce is disengaged. Like what do you do with that part of the workforce?
Well, first of all, I hate those studies because when you read them, you want to like take your life and close up shop. I mean,
you're referring to the Gallup studies.
Well, yes. And they're just, you know, they're just debilitating, right? I mean, 75% of my team's not disengaged. I'd say 99% of my team is disengaged. Now, I think they have a decent leader in me, one that's willing to sit down and laugh about our messes and celebrate our successes. But this is a tough question. I've been asked this question before. Challenge two is marketing is not just a division, right? It's recognizing that everybody's in sales, including you, John, and including me. Mm-hmm. Whether you think it or not, whether you want
it or
not.
I'm with you.
And everybody's in marketing, right? Whether it's your organization's brand or it's your own brand. I mean, here's an HR adage that I'll debunk. And that is leaders do not create engagement. We hear about engagement everywhere, right? Every company is fixated. Every board is fixated on engagement to solve the very problem you just mentioned. 75% of your workforce is disengaged. Not quite sure what that means. And don't school me on it, but we can debate that later. Leaders don't create engagement. I can't force you to be engaged. Leaders create the conditions whereby others choose their own level of engagement, high or low. So if I, as a leader, want you to be engaged, I create a culture where you feel respected, where your voice is heard, where you can bring your your fears and your passions to work. You can bring your whole self to work. Every bit about you, not just your secret life, not just your public life, not just your private life. You can bring your whole self to work. So I think the key of getting a culture where people are engaged is your leadership skill. You can't create someone to be an ambassador until they know that you love them, that you care about them, that you care about them more than just what they can do for your company. Too many leaders don't care about their people outside of their job at work.
I was really interested in your answer on this because part of it, I think, speaks to core beliefs or primal world beliefs, right? And I just interviewed Jer Clifton, who's a researcher at UPenn, who's heading up this research. And the primal world beliefs, the general one is the world good or bad? And then below that, is the world safe or dangerous? To what extent do you think one or the other? Is the world alive or mechanistic? Is the world enticing or dull? But it gets to this belief, I think, of to what extent do you believe people are good? Or what percentage of people do you think are good? And so I'm curious about your thought, like, can you put a percentage on what percentage of people out in the world in general would you say are good? Because I think in general, you're more optimistic on this.
Yeah. So here, I love this question. I do not rise to the stature of the majority of your guests. So I'm going to
riff with that
in mind. I'm going to riff with that in mind. I assume good intent. I am an optimist, but I'm grounded in realism. Nobody has ever screwed me. Not once in life. I've never been screwed because I'm too smart to put myself in a situation where someone could screw me. Mm. So you may have my credit card to go to Barnes & Noble, but you have a credit card that has a $3,000 limit, not an $80,000 limit. You may not know that, right? So I generally assume good intent in people. But I'm also extending smart trust to people. I don't extend trust to people who haven't earned it from me. But I also would choose to trust you and recognize I might get screwed, but I'm going to make sure that I protect it enough to where you can't bring me down in an irreparable fashion. But I do. I mean, you know, part of it might be my naivete. I have been very blessed to have been raised by solid parents. I've had great leaders. I've worked in great states and great cities and great cultures and great companies. I choose wisely. I'm pretty thoughtful about my decisions. I'm careful about who I associate with. I don't put myself in situations where I think I might be associating with people of dubious character. I'm sure the world is rife with evil and duplicity. I know that. Ask police officers. They deal with this all day long, right? Their entire day is dealing with criminal element of people who want to kill and maim and murder and destroy. That hasn't been my life. I'm sure if I was a police officer with 25 years, I'd have a different point of view. I have been blessed to live in Utah for 25 years, which is a generally very ethical, nice, well-run state, right? It's the Mormons, right? So my worldview has been shaped by my circumstance. But I also hope that if I had been in different circumstances, I would forgive easy. I do tend to forgive.
But here's the thing that's interesting, and pardon me for interrupting, but no, the thing that's fascinating about these primal world beliefs is that they seem to underlie our perceptions, our thoughts, our emotions, and our actions. And they're not correlated. They're not related to our circumstances. In other words, I had the same assumption that if I grow up in a really bad neighborhood, I don't know, in Richmond or Oakland, that I would believe the world is more dangerous. That's not the case, which is fascinating. But to get back to the core belief about people, like what percentage would you say, what percentage of people in general are mostly good?
In the world, in North Korea's government?
Well, let's say in the US.
Oh, I mean, 93%.
Okay.
I mean, I'm guessing I'm looking at, you know, I'm trying to think what population is incarcerated reasonably.
Thank you.
You know, John, I've learned something in life is, you know, I used to be a news junkie. I had to turn it off during the previous administration because I found it toxic. And I'm a lifelong Republican. I won't go any further than that. But I, you know, when you had doomsday news people and journalists talking about the future and all of this, What the smart people they interviewed, right? The Harvard and Princeton professors and the former Secretary of State, they all had one thing in common. They all were optimistic. They always talked about they could see it. And so I thought, you know what? These really smart, well-educated futurists, what they share is not a naive optimism, but they share a belief that man is inherently good and good will triumph evil, and that we'll figure it out and we'll help each other. We have a volunteer military. It's volunteer. And look at all the, look at during the pandemic, look at the millions of healthcare professionals that risked their lives, that died. They could have gotten in their car, driven home, and cashed out their 401k and gone to Key West. But doctors and nurses and healthcare workers and people that delivered breakfast and lunches, and I mean, they risked their lives to help people by the millions, and thousands of them died because they were saving people. I inherently think that 90 plus people in the world are good.
Yeah, I love
the
answer.
We see it every day.
I would say it's about, I don't know, 87%. I mean, that's just kind of my number, right? Because there's about 14%-ish, 13% that are, you know, narcissistic or sociopathic or borderlines. And so that's kind of my thinking. But I see a lot of depressed individuals that were like, the world's a dangerous place and all people are assholes. And it's like, if those are your two core beliefs, why bother? Like, why even go outside? So it's just fascinating to me. So
I do think the world is a dangerous place, but I don't think all people are assholes. I think that the world is a dangerous place and becoming more dangerous. You know, you and I are the same age. I was not raised even remotely facing the challenges my sons are facing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, pornography was, you got $3 and you and your buddies went over to 7-Eleven and stashed a magazine down at the lake. Now it's, you know, it's omnipresent in their life every moment. And the drugs, right? I mean, you know, maybe a kid smoked a cigarette during high school, right? And that was taboo. And now look at what's going on with marijuana legalized everywhere and such. So I don't mean to demonize marijuana. I just have my own feelings. I do think the world is a dangerous place and becoming more dangerous, whether it be with despotic politicians or nuclear arms or.
Okay. So another question. So to what extent do you think you hand down that belief of the world is a dangerous place to your sons and in an attempt to help them or keep them safe?
Yeah. So this is a great conversation. I am the father of a 6-year-old, a 9-year-old, and an 11-year-old boy. My wife,
God
and I
bless you.
It's challenging, and the fears they have and their anxiety they have. And so we talk soberly in our home, right? I had the talk with each of the boys at age 8, their two oldest ones. We talk about, you know, what's going on in Syria, what's going on in North Korea, what's going on with the pandemic. I don't overwhelm them. I calibrate for their maturity, but kind of on a need to know basis. They get irritated if they learn something on the news I haven't told them about a school shooting. There's certain things they need to know, and there's things they don't need to know, right? I do think that childhood is a balance of innocence, but awareness and empathy. You build empathy the more you are aware of other people. And so I don't hopefully place on them my fears. They don't know our financial situation. I mean, you know, they can guess it, right? But they generally, they're on a need to know basis.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. So let's go back to the book. Sorry to get off on these tangents. So let's talk about the third challenge. This is a big one. It seems for many of the execs that I work with, stay close to the cash. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So this is why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I was irritated at how many organizations, sales and marketing, are always fighting, right? Sales blames marketing and marketing sells out sales, and there's just that toxicity that is every CEO's worst nightmare, second only, I think, to a reputational breach in the firm. And so I wrote this book because I wanted to help to end the number of qualified marketers that hide in marketing because they don't want to own a sales number. They don't want to own the P&L. They don't know how to read a P&L, for God's sake. So I write a whole chapter about staying close to the cash. I also write a chapter about building your business acumen. This chapter is really about, as a marketer, are you connected to revenue generating activities? I think too many marketers are hiding behind social media and UX interface and brand equity. Let me tell you, you cannot staple brand equity to the back of a bank deposit slip and fund payroll off of it. Now, maybe Disney can and Procter & Gamble can, but for 99% of companies, brand equity is important, but we got to need payroll. We've got obligation. We can't grow we can't pay the SBA loan back if we're not putting cash in the bank. So this chapter is stay close to the cash. Is can you articulate how you are consistently generating revenue and profitable clients for the organization? Not falsely attaching yourself to some other initiative, but can you articulate how what you are doing is either saving money or driving profit for the firm? Not just about numbers of likes, numbers of impressions, and a great brand that we're building. Those things are important, but they come second to making sure you are in the boat with sales, rowing with them simultaneously.
I agree, absolutely. I mean, it's something that I've seen over and over, this rift between marketing and sales. And I love the idea of marketing being humble enough to see the role that they are playing in support and service of sales.
Amen. Hallelujah. PTL. Can I share a 30-second story?
Please.
I'm from Utah. I'm actually from Florida. I live in Utah. And the Utah Jazz had a very famous duo 20 years ago called John Stockton and Carl Malone.
And Carl Malone, the postman.
Now listen, the mailman. A basketball player. So if I slander this, take it for the intent. There was this very famous duo called Stockton to Malone, right? John Stockton was a very talented, shorter white guy.
An assist master.
Carl Malone was a exceptionally talented, taller black man. And they were very good friends. And they had this duo called Stockton to Malone. And it was always called out, John Stockton's job, loosely, was to get the ball up or near the net so Carl Malone could dunk it in. And I'm guessing John Stockton's stats are very different than Carl Malone, but this is like marketing and sales. I see marketing as the John Stockton. I see sales as the Carl Malone. Carl Malone would not be Carl Malone without John Stockton. And by the way, I think John Stockton made plenty of millions of dollars. I've seen his jet and his home. This is, I think, the metaphor for sales and marketing. I think that marketing is in service to sales. And here's the perfect illustration. When I was the chief marketing officer, I made the same amount of money, had the same title, same influence as the EVP of sales. We had both had large personalities. We had big egos. But at the end of the day, my job was to help him deliver on his number. Or more importantly, my job was to have us deliver on our number. And I'll tell you, there was many occasions when the CEO of the firm would, while we were both at the table, give me a sales goal. I'm like, I'm the marketing guy. Why are you giving it to me? The EVP of sales is right here. But it was a huge compliment because the CEO came to view me as equally as responsible for owning the number, the revenue goal, as he did the EVP of sales. And I think it's a paradigm that every marketer has to take. Your job is to make sure that sales delivers on their number just as much as they do.
Yeah, the first thought that comes to my mind is, oh my God, we're getting old. Stockton to Malone, that was decades ago. And I know exactly what you're talking about. But as long as we're going with old metaphors, it makes me think of Phil Jackson, like your mention of ego at that C level, right? Or the level of execs, the CEO almost has to be the Phil Jackson, the coach of like the Lakers or the Bulls, where he's got to get these big egos to work with each other and to play a role. And in a way to let go of the ego long enough to help the company to do what needs to be done.
Beautifully said, right? This is the role of every leader, is to get people to take off their functional hats occasionally. When I was on the executive team at Franklin Covey, chief marketing officer, I owned public relations, brand, business development, web, books, audio, all that kind of stuff. When we came into the executive team meeting, the COO took off her hat. The CFO took off his hat. The VP of marketing, EVP, took off her hats because we realized our job was to be more concerned with what is right than being right. Mm-hmm. And that's your point, right? It's humble leaders,
great way to
competent
put it.
Leaders are more concerned with what is right for the firm, for our clients, for our shareholders, for our organization than me being right. And that takes a level of trust amongst the team. It takes the leader modeling that I care more about what is right than being right too. And I'm willing to be open to influence. I'm willing to step back and admit that my passion is being clouded or my my strategy is being clouded. This is a special culture you create when everybody that works with you is more concerned with what is right than being right.
Well, and I really like the idea of focusing on psychological safety within a team like that, because when people feel safe, then they're more likely to admit they're wrong. Then they're more likely to come up with stupid brainstorming ideas to take a risk.
Or support someone else's idea, right?
Right. Or ask questions. Or, I mean, it's, but you have to feel safe in order to get there. If you've got a culture on a team of, you know, it's funny, anger often comes to mind, irritability, frustration, stress, but a lot of these negative emotions, I think, are some of the biggest keys to undermining psychological safety.
John, what you say is profound. I have been in so many boardrooms where they brought me in to give a, you know, 2-hour speech, and you can tell in 30 seconds what the culture of that board is. These are competent people that are making millions of dollars.
Wait, pardon me. Let me stop you there. So what is it that you pick up on within 30 seconds that tells you that?
You can pick up the rapport amongst people. Are they laughing?
How
are they formed physically into groups?
What's underlying that, do you think?
Deference to the chairman, fear.
Because I would say it's emotion.
Swagger, right? They're not part of a team. They are individual contributors masquerading as members of a team. You can feel it palpably.
So it's connection, right? Like it's either disconnection or connection, which I would say is based on emotion.
It's all a result of what the leader is modeling. It's the psychological safety. It's the role that the leader, the chairwoman, the chairperson has said, this is our purpose, right? This is what we are here to serve. This is the role we all need to play. We need to check our egos. We need to check our agendas. We need to check our hidden agendas. We are here to serve and play this role. And by the way, let's be safe to call each other out, including you call me out, right? As the leader sets the tone.
So is it okay to be wrong? I think is a big part of that. It, you know, can the CEO model?
It's not okay to be wrong. It's imperative that you're wrong. Compared that when you are wrong, you are able to say, you know what? You've got a great point. I'm realizing that I've been pushing this way too hard. And now that I really listened to your point, maybe we've gone too far on this strategy. I was interviewing Karen Dillon recently. She was the former editor of the Harvard Business Review. And she co-wrote a book with Clayton Christensen, called How Will You Measure Your Life? An amazing book. And in it, she shared some research, Sean, another scholar at Harvard, that said that 93% of successful organizations achieve that success with an emergent strategy, not the deliberate strategy that they set out with. Only 7% of organizations that achieve financial success did it with their original strategy. 93% had to change their mind, had to pivot mid-course. And I would bet that many of those came later than it should have, because the CEO or the board was so invested in their idea, their strategy, they weren't willing to be open to influence sooner. I mean, I think there is an art. I think it is a leadership competency, being willing to change your mind. You know, maybe you don't change
your mind. Well, it's funny. Values. I mean, like it's a hallmark of psychological health, psychological flexibility, cognitive flexibility. And I think it's one of the things that I always go back to when I'm speaking is this ability to shift gears mentally, which is why I like that framework that I gave you earlier, that, you know, where are you? Where's your mind trying to take you? Do you want to be there? Do you want to be able to shift out of the negative past or the negative future, worry, stress, dread? What are you feeling right now? Do you want to be feeling that, or do you want to shift out of it? Do you want to shift gears?
You've just articulated the key competency that's going to differentiate people post-pandemic. It is the people that are the most mentally agile, the most emotionally nimble, the ability to change their mind and realize, well, that's not the way it is anymore, and this is the way it's going to be now, and it might change again in the future. You just nailed the competency that is going to illustrate the people who are wildly successful post-pandemic and the people who retire when they're not ready, or who get eaten alive in a culture or an industry because they weren't able to pivot and change themselves. This is not an epiphany, but this should weigh heavily on your listeners, is how quickly can you see and adapt to a future state right now. This is what is going to differentiate people that crush it and those who fall behind post-pandemic.
And it's funny, like even as we're talking, I'm kind of looking at the meta here, I guess. And I think that one of the reasons I love talking to you is because there's so many ands. Like, I love what you're doing. I love the ideas. And I can build on those ideas. I can take them other places. And then you do the same. It's, you know, it's a lesson from improv comedy, right? You take what's given to you and you build upon it versus negating it and destroying it. Yeah. And you do that really well. I mean, I kind of feel like this is a love fest, but I have a great deal of respect for you at the same time. And so, yeah, I'm just watching what we're doing here. And I think that, you know, I was talking with a exec at a large healthcare company recently, and she wanted to really shake culture up and improve their culture. And I said, you know, if you really want to improve your culture, here's what I would do. I don't think it'll ever get done, but I would do a 360 assessment and find the 10% of your population that is the angriest and get rid of them.
The people who are retired but still working there. The people who are
I mean, what undermines psychological safety more than some degree of anger, irritation, frustration, resentment, annoyance? I can't think of anything. Yeah. I mean, I guess hidden agendas, to your point earlier. Manipulation, yeah. Deceit. Yeah.
Beautifully said. We could talk for hours about building culture and the roles that leaders play in it.
And I know just enough to be dangerous. You know, I don't consider myself an expert
in
this area.
I
just come at it from a different lens. So let me, there's one other point I want to get to, which, and you alluded to this earlier, but the 10th challenge, augment your business acumen, is such a big frickin' deal. Do you understand the business of your business? I love that.
Thanks.
So share a little bit about that, would you?
Yeah. So this again requires some humility, some vulnerability. And I think the best leaders, the best colleagues, heck, the best parents and partners and spouses are those that are self-aware and they're comfortable admitting what they don't know. A good friend of mine is Ann Chow. She is the CEO of AT&T Business. It's a $40 billion division of AT&T. She's the first female minority ever as the CEO at AT&T. One of her favorite phrases all the time with me is, I don't know about that. Teach me about that. This is a woman that is a Fortune 40 most powerful woman. She is the CEO of a $40 billion company. She's always saying, I don't know about that. Teach me about that. What should I learn about that? That shows confidence and humility. And it's the same with this one. Challenge 10 is augment your business acumen. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in marketing are probably more right-brained than left-brained. They're probably more creative types than they are processors or linear thinking. Not all of them, but I think it's a fair generalization. And therefore, when I was, 32, I was promoted from being an individual contributor, very successful, independent salesperson, to becoming a general manager of a $20 million division. And in the training business, that's a big number. I didn't know how to read a P&L. I had no idea the difference between gross revenue and gross profit. I had no idea what SG&A stood for or that COGS was cost of goods sold. I had no idea how to calculate EBIT or EBITDA. I didn't know the difference between a P&L and a balance sheet. I was 32, so I had to learn it. And once I learned all the levers of a P&L, I became an indispensable vice president and executive vice president and named executive officer. As an entrepreneur now, you better be damn straight. I got to know how to run a P&L. So the point of this is, if there's parts of your business that you don't understand, show the vulnerability to go ask. Like, I had to give a speech 2 weeks ago on AI. I was on a panel with the chief technology officer of IBM. I know, go figure. They wanted to learn what kind of leadership skills were necessary for a digital transformation. So I'm on this panel with all these expert AI people. And here's the leadership guys. You know what I did? I called up five friends. Who do you know that knows about AI? I called up Seth Godin. I called up Dan Pink. I called up my brother, who's a chemical engineer. And he took me up with one of his MIT people. I voraciously read about it. And I was very comfortable saying, I can't even spell AI, let alone know what AI even is, right? I learned so much. I held my own on that panel because I was very comfortable just admitting, I need to learn this. Tell me about this. So augmenting your business acumen, to quote you, is, do you understand the business of your business? Ram Charan, the famous, you know, CEO coach and author, says there's five parts of business: cash, margin, velocity, customers, and growth. Cash, margin, velocity, customers, and growth. And you need to understand how all those levers play in your business, which ones you could impact the most. Stay close to the cash. And if your company or organization doesn't have a P&L, either it's a private company or perhaps it's a non-for-profit and they keep it, not whatever reason, go understand the parts of the business that you can influence the most, and you will be the last person to be furloughed or downsized. You'll be the first person to be promoted because the leadership will now associate with you with understanding the business of the business and how you can contribute. It'll be an impact player that has, you know, self-motivated contribution like few others might have.
Yeah, I've seen this over and over. I did a project many years ago, kind of interviewing the best VPs of HR. And amazingly, like 80% of them came from Pepsi. And I was like, what the hell is Pepsi doing to train these great leaders down the road? Wow. And what they did is they would pluck kids out of college and they would throw them for 18-month assignments into every area, regardless of what they knew. And everyone that I talked to was like, yeah, I was doing like labor union negotiations and I was 25. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I learned a lot. Or, you know, I was in compensation. I didn't know what I was doing, but I learned so much. And I think the other thought that comes to mind is this idea of the growth mindset from Carol Dweck, that, you know, you say humility, I'm looking at it as, well, yeah, they also have a growth mindset that they are willing and able to learn about this stuff. And I would say, you know, you've mentioned curiosity a couple of times, and I think that curiosity serves us really well in these instances.
Can I share a 1 minute story?
Please.
I know we're landing this.
And then we got to wrap up because you've got to go.
I was preparing for an interview with Brian Grazer, the famous Hollywood producer, right? Imagine Entertainment, Ron Howard's partner. And I was reading his book. He has a book called A Curious Mind. Phenomenal book. Brian Grazer is the Hollywood guy with the crazy hair, right? As soon as you see his picture, you know who he is. And he mentioned that he was preparing for a science fiction movie he was thinking of producing. So he went out and he asked the famous scientist, Isaac Asimov, right? He wrote like 100 books and he died a few years ago. Could he pick his brain? So Brian Grazer, the famous Hollywood producer, goes to lunch with Isaac Asimov, one of the greatest scientific minds of our generation, and his then wife. I think might have been his third or fourth wife. That's immaterial. Salacious, but immaterial. You sit down at lunch at like the, in New York City, I think it was the Ritz, and Brian Grazer starts asking Isaac Asimov some questions. He's just picking his brain to better understand this science to see if he wants to option this movie. 10 minutes into the interview, Isaac Asimov's wife stands up and says, "This interview is over. By the nature of your shallow questions, you clearly have not paid the price to understand the gravity of my husband's work. We're out." And she got up, took Isaac Asimov's hand, and they left Brian Grazer sitting there. And Brian shares this story about rude, but right. She was right. He hadn't paid the price to really study Isaac Asimov's work. And so that haunts me, right? As I interview people, I read their books and I prepare. The same thing is, curiosity is the greatest sign of respect you can show someone. And it is what will constantly reinvigorate your skills and disrupt yourself, right? And transform yourself to being relevant. If Brian Grazer can admit that he'd not paid the price to be worthy, you can too.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story.
Ooh. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm looking at the time and we have to wrap up, unfortunately. And I just want to say thank you. I love these conversations. I value the friendship and I look forward to more in the future.
Hey, if I can ever help you, call on me. Thank you for your abundance mentality. What was your number? 87%? What was your number of?
87%.
87.
But I will take yours. I will take yours at 93. I think
that's a good
number.
What? You're more credible and you've spent a lot of time with a lot of troubled people, you know, trying to help them transform their lives. I haven't. So I still think 87% is sending me off with a good day.
And do me a favor, share with listeners where they can pick up your book.
Yeah. So you can buy my books all over Amazon, anywhere you buy books, online or in print and digitally or on in bookstores. You can visit me at scottjeffreymiller.com. If you Google Scott Miller, it's likely my mug will come up.
Very good. Thank you so much. Thank you, John. And that's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Be sure to like, rate, and review. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.